Blog Talk Radio.
Ronnie Don Show. My name is Don Allen, or Studio B. It's Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, it's a pretty nice evening out there. How are you?
Mr. Allen, it is a beautiful evening here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, in the heart of the homeland, if you will. A lot of things going on, if you will. We're going to be talking a little bit and quite a bit about the civil rights department of the city of Minneapolis and its adjunct components, as well as an interesting meeting, hearing today before the powerful public safety committee of the Minneapolis City Council under the chairmanship of Long Yang, Councilman DFL 5th Ward. I got to tell you, Council President Barb Johnson, pulled the covers off some folks, but we will get to that probably almost at the top of the hour. So we want to take a look right now. I understand, Mr. Allen, we have a guest in the queue. Want to take a look at a long-standing kind of feud that has been going on involving the very powerful and seeking a position as a district court judge, Michael Brown. The man who sits as the executive director of the Office of Police Conduct Board, or whatever they want to call themselves. Mr. Brown has taken on the position that he is, quote-unquote, the godfather of police community relations and et cetera, with the support of his boss, Velma Corvell, Police Conduct Oversight Commission, as it's also referred to. Don, let's take us into the discussion. Introduce our guest.
Yeah, tonight we're happy to have Dave Becking with us. I've seen a lot of narrative between him and another gentleman named Chuck on e-democracy here locally in the Minneapolis Forum, and also the many years that they've been involved with Michelle Gross and others of addressing this Michael Brown character and some of the what I would allege is some slippery dealings with the citizens of Minneapolis. And so, Dave, welcome to the show.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your main concerns are with the police conduct review?
Okay, I've been involved in issues of police accountability and in the Minneapolis for quite a long time. I worked with Communities United Against Police Brutality. I was a member of the Civilian Review Authority back for 2 years, 2008 to 2010. And since that time, I continued to follow the Civilian Review Authority and its work. And then in 2012, when it was gotten rid of, and this Office of Police Conduct Review, or OPCR, came into place, I've been watching that and going to the meetings and following the statistics on that quite closely. We could tell at the time that it was not going to work, and sure enough, what we've seen is that it doesn't work.
Okay, what's the problem? Or the challenges?
The problem is it's supposed to be a level of civilian review of police conduct, and in particular to handle complaints that people in the city have about the conduct of Minneapolis police, anything from rudeness to excessive force. And about 400 complaints are filed per year with the department, and it's supposed to lead to some consistent discipline for bad officers, which would, correct their behavior, hopefully, or would deter other officers from misbehaving in the same way. The problem is that virtually no discipline results as a result of these 400 complaints per year, so that it has absolutely no effect in what's really important for civilian review, is to make sure that there is discipline and that people have an effective way to complain about police behavior without having to complain to the police about the police and then having the police investigate themselves.
Okay, well, I'm seeing a couple challenges here because, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Michael Brown, Velma Cord Bell, and the police get their paychecks from the same people.
Yes,
so,
they do. The Civil Rights Department is directly overseen by the mayor. The police department is directly overseen by the mayor. And so, yes, you have the fox guarding the hen house, as they say. You have the police investigating the police, and to a small extent, to the extent there is any civilian investigation or oversight, it's the Civil Rights Department, which reports to the same people. So that's a problem to begin with. It was set up with the Civilian Review Authority, was also under the Civil Rights Department, but it had more independence, and it had far more civilians involved with it. Civilian review in any city is not very effective, because it can only recommend action of the police chief. And in Minneapolis, as in most places, it was underfunded, didn't have the money to do the investigations in a timely way. But it was a civilian body where you could bring a complaint and have it investigated by a civilian investigator and evaluated by a panel of civilians without any police involvement along the way, which is the way it should be. It was one of the better ones in the country, as they say, though none of them are very effective. It was, I think, because it had some effect and because particularly it was beginning to show how the police department wasn't doing a very good job at disciplining its own, that back in sometime in fall of 2011, that a couple of people in the city decided that they should do a different kind of supposedly civilian review. And it was Velma Corbel, Michael Brown, probably the mayor to some extent, the police chief, who...
Now, the mayor at that
time,
though, was R.T. Ryback. We want to be fair with our international domestic
audience.
Right. Yeah, it would be R.T. Ryback.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
That's right, yes. The other people are the same. Well, the police chief at that time was
Tim
Dolan also.
Yes.
So
we had him under federal supervision.
Right, yes. But they got together and came up with a new idea, supposedly, for civilian oversight of the police, which is unlike anywhere in the country ever. They called it innovative. Basically, it was made up to be absolutely ineffective, and there were several problems with it. One is that the civilian oversight was merged directly into the same department as the police internal affairs unit, so that it was a hybrid body where everybody's working together and you don't get the independence of the civilian side of it. It also
let me do this for our listening audience so that they get a feel for what our guest is speaking about.
Yeah.
Police complaint process, you have that document laid out. You have intake, review, and then out of that comes possibly dismissal, coaching, mediation, investigation, and then if it goes further, dismissal, review panel, and then the final arbitrator is the chief. Tell us where all of this falls apart.
Right. Well, there are many steps in there, and aside from one step in the middle, it's done entirely by the police department or by Michael Brown himself and a couple of civilian investigators who work for him. A person filing a complaint can request a civilian investigator, but they have no guarantee of getting that. So they may be filing the complaint really directly with the police department in that sense. So many of the complaints are dismissed right out of hand, way too early in the process. before there is any chance for any real investigation, and certainly before the officer is ever interviewed. And through the process,
but,
as it goes through this, I'm sorry, yes, right.
No, no, I was just, you keep going, but I also want to say on the line
right,
with us,
right.
On the line with us now, joining us is Ms. Michelle Gross of Citizens United Against Police Brutality here in the Twin Cities. Ms. Gross, welcome to the
Ms.
show.
Oh, Ms. Gross? Oh, okay. Welcome, Ms. Gross. I've not seen her since I appeared on a panel back in, February. But go ahead, James, let you continue, and then we would pick up some observations from Ms. Gross.
Right. Sure, sure. So as it goes through the process, far too many complaints are sent for coaching, which means that there's coaching isn't even considered discipline. It's a sort of, you shouldn't have done that, kind of talk with the officer. Though even most of the complaints that are sent to go for coaching don't even get any coaching. The supervisor says, there's no merit to it anyway, and doesn't do anything. Finally, some complaints go to an investigation. Halfway through the investigation, before they even talk to the officer, it's decided whether to go any further, and many of them get dismissed at that point. Finally, in the last 2.5 years, 962 complaints submitted, and only 53 of those, well under 10%, went to a review panel. And here's where you finally have two civilians taking a look at the case, appointed by the mayor and the city council, so again, there's connections there. But the two civilians sit on a panel with two high-ranking police officers. So they, and if there is any a tie vote, basically the police chief breaks the tie. So that the civilians really have no authority in this process whatsoever. And as a result, we had 53 cases come to a panel, 163 allegations, accusations in those cases, and only 36, less than a quarter of them,
We certainly have plenty of time, but we want to get to the meat and keep the interest of our listening audience, both domestically and internationally. I want to kind of take a look, because apparently a former member of one of the task forces created as a part of an agreement between the city of Minneapolis and the federal government submitted a rather scathing email on the 7th day of May, 2015. And he made some pretty serious allegations, raised some real tough questions, it appears. Now, this comes at a time, and I'm happy that we have Ms. Gross with us. It comes at a time when I'm made to understand that the organization that both you and Ms. Gross, as an example, are very much involved with, have been raising questions about the authenticity and accurateness of some of the documentation, some of which you've just touched on in the last seven or 8 minutes, which there seems to be some inconsistencies. Now, Ms. Gross raised a question about 4 months ago about the accurateness, the authenticity, the integrity of the process. Am I correct to understand that the Committee Against Police Brutality, with the support of appropriate legal representatives, have been attempting to ascertain this information and have been turned back by Mr. Brown? Could either one of you want to take that?
I'd be delighted to answer that question, and the answer is absolutely yes. We submitted a data practice request well over a month ago. We've made multiple attempts to follow up with the city to get them to provide us with the data, and to this day, we still do not have it. It would seem to me that they're making every attempt to keep us from getting the data in a timely fashion where we could use it to actually address some of the discrepancies that we are seeing in both the, we're seeing discrepancies. Let me just back this up a little bit for a second. We've done some significant analysis of the study that was done by the Office of Justice Programs and of the City of Minneapolis Police Department. And there's significant discrepancies between the draft report that they did and the final report that they did. And not only that, but there are huge discrepancies between those reports and the reports from the OPCR itself. So this
OJP. Okay, now that is an entity of the Department of Justice. So we're not talking about some people that you folks got together on a street corner and asked them to take a look at some documents. This was the Department of Justice. Now, I'm hearing a rumor that information was withheld from the powerful chairman of the Public Safety Committee, the council president, and others when some of these discrepancies, Ms. Gross, that you and your organization had been speaking to for a number of months, the Department of Justice. Now, I'm hearing this. I certainly have no verification per se, but I'm hearing that there was a delay of about 4 months in getting the OJP recommendations and the subcommittees and committees operational, because Mr. Brown's organization had submitted questionable data, which you just kind of touched on. Is that correct?
You know, I only have the same rumors that you have, but this is my understanding, is that there was a significant delay, because I understand that the city had to engage in a significant outlay of funds to try to correct that data. I mean, again, this is rumors. I don't have confirmed documentation, but when you look at the numbers, and I've been busy putting together charts outlining the differences in the numbers, and they are really significant. You know, there's just, this kind of data should be being kept in a reporting function. There should be little to no discrepancy, because, you know, when you have complaints, they go into some kind of a computer system that tracks them. There ought to be a way for you to be able to generate reports from that system that are accurate. It's just astounding to me, you know, and it makes me really have to question, not just, you know, is this a record-keeping error or some kind of bookkeeping error, but the real motivation behind such discrepancies. Because this is the day and age of computers. You know, we're not using paper ledgers anymore.
But let me get clear in my mind, because everyone has been talking within the liberal city structure that they wanted to work closely with organizations, and particularly an organization, Ms. Rose. I mean, I'm aware of your organization, have been for many, many years, support many of the things that and causes and issues that they've taken up. But I'm not understanding the resistance by Mr. Brown, I assume with the concurrence of the mayor. How did this begin to intensify?
The situation is this. Really the situation comes down to this. There is a deliberate effort to obfuscate the fact that this agency is completely ineffective. You know, the Civilian Review Authority was no great shakes, and Dave was right about that. But in its best year, it sustained roughly 5-7% of cases, and it tracks pretty legitimately with civilian oversight bodies across the country. Depending on model, they tend to sustain roughly 5-7% of cases. This agency, on the other hand, has sustained 1% of cases. But if you hide the numbers, if you doctor the numbers in some fashion, or you put out reports that deliberately obfuscate the numbers and make it hard for people to figure out what those numbers are, then that's how you can get away with a kind of a mechanism. You know, when this whole thing started with this OPCR, when this was, put together in the back rooms of the Civil Rights Department with the blessing of the former mayor and frankly with a lot of activity on the part of certain members of the city council, when this happened back in the day, there was all of this nonsensical talk about, transparency, and isn't this going to be a great process, and, the city won't discipline the CRA sustained complaints anyway, so now at least the cops can have something to say about it, so maybe they'll accept the results better, and all of this stuff. Well, first of all, I think having an agency that the cops accept the results of is not a correct or valid objective.
I don't want to cut you off, but there's so much information, because we are hearing so many favorable declarations that everything is working, there's no problem. I think that Mr. Brown, in fact, Mr. Brown is the co-chair or vice chair of the Conduct Oversight Committee of the OJP recommended structure. I was in a meeting with you a little over 3 years ago at Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church in North Minneapolis. I don't know if you remember that meeting. And I remember the meeting became very intense given the way that Mr. Brown was talking to the community people that were gathered there. It was on a night when we were put in a back room because they were having a gospel concert in the front of the church, Mr. Allen. And so it was rather interesting to sit in that meeting and try to have a meaningful dialogue. But I thought that Mr. Brown was extremely ugly and disrespectful to the citizens that had been gathered there. Maybe it was just my own observation, if you will. But I thought things had been improving. I mean, I'd been hearing through sources that Mr. Brown is talking in terms of how he is meeting with the community, working with the community. In fact, I'm aware of a discussion that took place in which Mr. Brown was asked about his relationship with your organization, with other key members of your organization and other community activists. And he said in the meeting that there were no complaints whatsoever coming from your group. I'm beginning, Mr. Allen, you can see where I'm coming from. I'm beginning to get the feeling that that just wasn't true. Can you kind of help me here on this, Ms. Wilson?
I would have to confirm that they're doing their usual sidestep, you know, that political sidestep shuffle, they call it.
You know, here's the interesting thing. When this whole thing came up about them trying to develop this so-called new model of civilian oversight, which is, by the way, not a model of civilian oversight at all, but when they were talking about developing this, the process through which they developed it was completely disrespectful to the community. We raised major alarms. We organized hundreds of people to show up at these various meetings to, you know, expressed their great displeasure at the dismantling of the Civilian Review Authority and this new process. And everything that we said that was going to happen in this new process has absolutely and sadly become true. The most important and significant thing is, again, less than 1% of complaints that have been received have been sustained and disciplined in any fashion. This is far below the national average for civilian oversight bodies. But more than that, in the old CRA, which, again, wasn't any great shake, it had its own problems, but in the old Civilian Review Authority, the people that sat on the panel and listened to the complaints also held a monthly meeting that you as a community member could attend, and you could say, hey, you guys are not doing this right, or, hey, this is a trend that's happening in the community that you should pay some attention to. You know, we knew, and we have always known it as an organization because we run a 24-hour hotline. We often know much more about what's going on with the police in the community than these agencies because they don't get the number of complaints we get. We've always gotten three or four or even five times as many complaints in our through our hotline as the Civilian Review Authority or now the OPCR ever received. And so we know a lot more about what's happening. And then going to these meetings, we were able to tell them, hey, these are the things that are going on that you guys ought to be paying some attention to. Now you have no access to these people that sit on this panel. You don't get to know really who they are at all except for the consultation.
Well, wait,
process.
I have to raise the question to you, Ms. Gross, because I am told that Mr. Brown, as recently as a month ago, in a closed meeting with the Federal Oversight Committee, someone asked him the question about relationships, affiliation with communities, et cetera. And the question was posed because someone had seen you being interviewed on the occasion where you had raised questions about the authenticity of the numbers. And Mr. Brown said clearly and concisely that there was no problem whatsoever. He was not aware of any concerns that you have.
Well, he's not paying any attention to anything. It is complete nonsense.
Let us hear, Jeff. I mean, you're saying that. I mean, clarify for me, because I'm told by sources that he clearly indicated that all of these rumors about problems was just invented by people, that he had an excellent relationship and had no concerns expressed. In fact, he didn't know about the press interview that Ms. Gross had, which was about, I think, about 3 or 4 months ago. Clarify for us. I mean, is somebody pulling somebody's chain here or what?
Well, we have written numerous emails and been at the meetings of the one body that does meet in public and have been very critical of the OPCR and of Michael Brown for not releasing information. We've been critical of Michael Brown from the beginning as not facilitating communication with the community. For a long time, we couldn't even email the commissioners on the public side of this.
Well, is that because they didn't have emails or what? Why was
that? The city would not set them up with emails, and we were told, no, they could not get emails. And if we wanted to contact them, we had to put something in writing, and they would get it at the meeting, which means they wouldn't get a chance to read it until after the meeting. Or if later on we could send an email to the office, and they would print it out and give it to them at the meeting, but not before the meeting.
Well, now,
let me
say this, folks. Yeah. This then takes us back to the May 7th text by a former member of the subcommittees in which he, Mr. Allen and I both have copies of this text. He raised these questions. Now, I understand on yesterday he sent a second email to Mr. Brown and to Commander Granger indicating that he was disappointed that they, as well as other people that had been identified on the May 7th memo, including the mayor of our city, had not given him a response and had not shown any concern or interest in the observations that he made. My own limited understanding of things. He raised some pretty tough questions in his May 7th email, and then reinforced that on yesterday with an email. Now, I want to be clear on this. We want to be fair here on the Ron and Don program. I'm having to say to both of you, and I've known Ms. Gross for many years, that Mr. Brown says that there's just no problem at all. Things are just hunky-dory. Things have been going in a great manner of consistency, transparency, and et cetera. I'm hearing something different, or am I some way or another reaching for straws?
No, you are
you
not,
are not
at
reaching.
All. We put out a document back last July which tallied up the statistics that were put out by the OPCR itself. In other words, this was taken entirely from their reports. It showed that there was virtually no discipline. It showed that so many cases were just discarded so early in the process. We sent that document to the city council. We sent it to the civil rights department. We sent it to the mayor. And we passed out hundreds and hundreds of copies of it at public meetings. And basically what it says, it asks, is there any civilian review in Minneapolis? And is it working? Is it effective? The answer based on the statistics below is clearly no. And at the bottom of the document it says the OPCR must be scrapped. And basically it has no merit in terms of doing what it should be doing with citizen complaints. We brought that out last July. And
last July?
Had that,
wow.
Right, last July. We just updated it a couple of weeks ago to cover the first 2.5 years. The results are pretty much the same, but it's at least updated now. So, and we provided copies of that to members of the Police Conduct Oversight Commission back a month ago. So if he doesn't know, he can't read because
let me raise a question again to these emails that have been sent out by a former member who resigned in protest. Mm-hmm. There's a document in which the heading is the Police Conduct Oversight Commission about to eliminate public comment in its meetings. Has that been threatened, that the public would not be allowed to give public comment?
Yeah.
Well,
in the meeting just before this last one, in other words, about a month ago, the agenda came out, and the public comment that had been on the agenda for many, many, many months, as is the case all along in the case of the Civilian Review Authority, that was missing from the agenda, and there was instead on the agenda a chair's discussion on public comment. Well, this makes you wonder if there's a discussion, supposedly, actually it turned out to be just a monologue by the chair, and the thing is not on the agenda, it makes you wonder. As it turns out, other members of the PCOC asked for the agenda to be modified to add the public comment back in. So it was there, and at this point it seems like there's going to be public comment. But much more important, during her monologue on public comment, she raised another very important issue, and that is there's this civilian body which does meet in public once a month called the Police Conduct Oversight Commission. Note the word oversight in their name. And she went on about how they were looking at cases in order to see if there were policy troubles going on and that they could recommend policy to the Minneapolis Police Department. But her
so let me ask the question,
that this body
is,
could
is,
not
is this Ms. Brown that we're talking about?
This is Chair Andrea Brown.
Yes, PCOC Chair.
Right.
Oh, okay,
right, yes.
okay.
Right, right.
I have to
so
say
she was
something.
Saying that they, right, go ahead.
Well, I just have to say, it is so clear after attending these meetings that Chair Brown, Andrea Brown, no relation to Michael Brown, by the way, that Chair Brown, however, takes her marching orders from Michael Brown. It is clear as a bell, you know, that she does really essentially whatever he tells her to do and not a drop more and isn't, you know, in no way an appropriate representation of what is necessary for the community, you know. She's not working for the community one iota.
Oh, this is
I'm just
rather shocking.
That is my absolute
on,
opinion.
Okay, I didn't mean to cut you off, but this is shocking based on testimony given to the Federal Oversight Committee by Mr. Brown with regards to how well things are working.
Right.
Have you had any discussion with the Public Safety Committee of the City Council about allowing at least a meeting of concern by your respective organizations and et cetera? I mean, is the chair of the Public Safety Committee, my good friend Councilman Yang, is he aware of all of this?
Yes, he's been made aware of this. You know, back when this thing was first formed, it was, as you say, innovative and different. And the council wanted to Chair Brown to come back, not Chair Brown, but Michael Brown to come back after a year in Velma Corbel and report on how the thing was going. After 1 year, you'll recall there was that big Star Tribune headline above the fold with a picture that said, 1 year, 439 complaints, zero discipline. But the city council heard some from the people at the OPCR, and they said, well, we got to give it time to work. Let's wait and see. And so at 2 years, we suggested to several of the members of that committee and to the committee as a whole that they now have another review of this now that we've had another year of documentation. Basically, we're told, well, this examination by the Department of Justice is underway. Let's wait and see what they say. Well, that took a lot longer than expected, but in the end of January, they brought out the report that we've talked about from the Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs. And at that point, we again asked for the City Council to reevaluate the functioning of this organization. And we haven't heard anything yet. We're hopeful that the information that's coming out now will lead to a serious reexamination of this organization and how it's functioning and how basically it's not doing anything for the community. But we
I hope that happens. I certainly encourage Ms. Gross and yourself to make inquiry early tomorrow about the possibility of speaking with the steering committee of the federal oversight. And the possibility of being able to reflect some of your concerns to that body, because I'm pained really to say that. I mean, I'm told by again reliable sources that Mr. Brown has indicated that there is no problem whatsoever. You know, all the things that you are saying here as an example are just a misrepresentation, doesn't exist. Ghosts have been putting these kinds of things out. And yet I am aware that it appeared that high-ranking city officials were not aware of the fact that there had to be a four-month delay because, as Ms. Gross said earlier in this program, Mr. Allen, that it looked like the numbers weren't correct. And I think about my friend, Mr. Sam Reed, when I think about bad figures and bad information and documents disappearing. I guess that's why he left to take a similar position in Atlanta, Georgia. But I certainly hope that, that there's some opportunity for the Federal Oversight Committee to hear these comments by both of you. I just think it would be so important. But, Mr. Brown is such a powerful man. I mean, he has friends in high places, starting with the mayor's office, if you will. And, of course, let me ask this question as we begin to wrap, though. Any other additional things, observations you have, you are welcome, because we're going for an hour and a half. Have you attempted to reach out to Mr. Brown's immediate boss, the powerful civil rights director, Velma Corvell?
She's as much or more of a problem than Michael Brown is, and we've been stonewalled in the same way there. One of the problems, the report that came from the Department of Justice has said wonderful things about the OPCR, and that's because they only talked to a very select handful of people and have not provided us with any idea of how they selected those people. But you'll note in the report, instead of the Department of Justice saying, oh, this is a good body and it's doing a good job, instead they say stakeholders interviewed provided consistent feedback that MPD is moving in the right direction. Stakeholders observed efforts to shift the culture toward accountability and transparency, and stakeholders recommended recognized the new community outreach strategies as positive shifts. Basically, the Department of Justice did not take a position and yet made it appear that everything was fine, and they based it on comments of anonymous stakeholders who were clearly chosen by Michael Brown and the police chief, and we have asked and asked and asked, and they refuse to tell us how those people were chosen and who they were. So we have this inner circle that just reinforces itself about how wonderfully the system is working, and they feed data to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice didn't independently. And you talk about the speculation of the numbers changing. One thing we do know for sure is the draft report came out and was presented on October 8th. And we were told at that time it would take 4 to 6 weeks for them to finish it off and bring a final report. The final report did not come out until January 28th, 3.5 months later. What happened in the meantime is the data in the report changed. Now, the Department of Justice had gotten that data early in 2014 and had put that data in the draft report. When the final report comes out 2 months later than they expected, and the data is different, we know they must have gone back for another look at the data. So something was wrong with that original data.
Well, maybe that's
so we can speculate about how this works,
and
that is factual information.
Yeah.
Right. And yet, despite the fact that the data changed, their recommendations did not. And their recommendations are so incredibly faulty, more particularly recommendations related to, their glorification of the OPCR process, a ridiculous glorification of it, not deserved, but also their glorification of coaching as a solution to police misconduct. Coaching is the way the city deals with complaints that turns them not into an actual and legitimate discipline, but keeps the complaints as private data. This is nothing but a strategy, but for removing, under the Minnesota Data Practices Act, removing public access to complaints. That's all it is. And the fact that the OJP glorified that is, shows that
they
never spoke.
Well, we're going to have to break it off. And my colleague, Mr. Allen, do you have any observation?
We have a caller that's been on hold. I'd like to get them in and see what kind of question they have. Caller, you're live on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, Mr. Edwards and Don Allen. How are you both?
Real good. Hey, what can we do for you?
Minneapolis City Councilman Blog Yang.
Oh,
five.
Councilman Yang. How are you doing, sir? Yes, yes. Glad to have you aboard. Obviously, you've been listening to the discussion and the conversation. Can you give us a little guidance here?
I just caught a little bit of it, so you guys have to get me up to speed because I'm not really up to speed.
Well, we have Michelle Gross on the air with us and also Dave Bicking and, of course, Mr. Edwards, and we've been talking about the Office of Police conduct review. And I'll let Mr. Edwards, if you'd like to bring him up to speed on exactly where we're at, that'd be great.
Yes, 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 Mr. Chairman. Some of this is being driven by a series of emails, one dated May 7, 2015, from a former member of one of the subcommittees, in fact, the coaching committee. And then there was apparently a – well, not apparently, there was a email sent yesterday to Mr. Brown and Commander Granger indicating there had been no response to the questions raised on May 7th. Consequently, we have been talking with two individuals, particularly Ms. Gross, who has been saying to us that they have been attempting to gain information from Mr. Brown and his Police Conduct Oversight Commission and have been unsuccessful. But also, they have made some reflections, statements, that talk in terms of really a hostile kind of relationship, a hostile kind of discussions, if you will, and going back to July of last year, attempting to get a, or some way or another, nurture a better relationship with the Office of Police Conduct Oversight Commission. And then they have some real serious questions about the numbers. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Gross and her colleague just got through walking through a timeline, Councilman, that is kind of makes one a little bit uneasy with regards to how accurate the numbers are or were that were coming out of the police oversight, or as it's called, Police Conduct Oversight Commission. So that's kind of been the flavor of what we've had. We've been going at it for about, 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And I was a little bit taken back that there had been such a lack of cooperation and communication, because I can well remember when statements were made that, you know, the head of the Office of Police Conduct Oversight was not even aware that there was a concern, you know.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to get my mind around that based on what it is that we have a tendency to hear. But the Committee Against Police Brutality and its other adjunct committees have been pretty pacific. And particularly the email there was a CC to you, Councilman,
mm-hmm.
But to the mayor and others, you know, which it's somewhat disturbing because I keep hearing from Mr. Brown's operation that everything is just wonderful and that he has just an excellent relationship with the community people. In fact, I asked a question early on about meetings in the community with their group and et cetera, and they said to me, to Mr. Allen and myself, that there are no meetings in the community.
Right. That's what my understanding is too. And I think CUAPB and other groups like that, I mean, they serve a really good purpose, you know, as watchdogs. I mean, what we've seen in the past is that at least with the OJP reporting, and you know, when the OJP came in to look at our numbers, I mean, you know, it was proven right that CUAPB actually got some numbers right, and you know, they made some questions. They had a lot of you know, input on that, and you know, it was proven that their issues with regards to some of the stats that were provided, they were actually right on that. So, you know, I think they play a really important role.
You know, sir, that is very refreshing, and it is very compelling also, to the extent that I've heard so much here in the last couple of months that have maligned Ms. Gross and her organization. And I know I have an appreciation that a very high-ranking government official, or in this case city official, has indicated that they were on point. Because I was in a meeting one time, twice in fact, and Mr. Brown made the statement that he had no knowledge whatsoever of any concerns or questions being posed by Ms. Gross and her associates. And, I maybe offended some the gentleman by saying that it did happen, but he seemed to be offended that it was even suggested that it was happening. And now I hear a public official who I have great respect and trust of, that being you, indicating that Ms. Gross and her associates were on point. Am I correct in how I phrase
that?
Yeah,
I mean, those are the facts. I mean, that's what we understand it to be.
Wow.
I'm not making it up. I mean, that's what our police department has said. That, you know, at some point we did have to correct our numbers to get them more correct. That, you know, some of the numbers just weren't pulled out correctly. And so, you know, when Ms. Gross and other folks pointed that out, I mean, we looked at it and it proved that they were right.
Wow.
So
it's
a fact. I mean, it's not like anything that we're making up. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, no, I that's why I have a great appreciation, because I sat in a setting in which I was clearly told that whatever my assumption was mistaken with regards to concern by community organizations. Wow. Well, it's going to be interesting then, you know, because I'm quite sure that the head of the office and Ms. Corville and her staff will have an explanation on how things are being corrected, and that this would not happen again, okay, because I think it was an embarrassment for the city that should not have happened. But, Mr. Allen, is Ms. Gross and is Kurt still with us? Or?
Yes, they are. Yes, they're
still here.
Okay. Ms. Gross, I think I would give you the opportunity to respond to what is a stunning confirmation and reaffirmation of the things that I saw you say on a TV program that I was told didn't exist in an interview. do you care to respond?
Well, I will respond and thank Council Member and Chair, Committee Chair Long Yang for his affirmation. But more particularly, you know, it's not about being right about the numbers, and I know that we are, because we pay very close attention to these things and we try to be extremely accurate in the things we say. But it's not just about being right about the numbers, but it's also about the fact that this is a system, a mechanism that is not working for the community. And we really need to get the city council, you know, we're going to keep hammering away at these numbers until we get someone to pay attention to the fact that this thing is not working. This is not a valid method of so-called community control of the police or community oversight. We need someone to begin to say it's time to take another look at this thing. And so we're going to keep hammering away at that, not just because we like picking on people or whatever, but because we really need a mechanism that works in this community to hold police accountable and to provide a really transparent way for the community to know what's going on with policing and to improve policing. And so that's really our goal. It's not, like I said, about being, you know, whether we're mad at this person or that person or what our relationships. It's really about ensuring a real mechanism of community oversight of the police that actually improves police conduct and police community relations.
All right. Well, I want to thank both you and your colleague, and I most certainly want to extend my appreciation to the chairman of the Public Safety Committee for confirming that a community group was correct in their observations, et cetera. Chairman Yang, I don't feel so bad now about making the statement that I saw Ms. Gross on TV indicating concern about the numbers, and I was basically told that that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was on another planet.
Mr. Edwards, I mean, that should never be a surprise, though. I mean, I think we have to work in collaboration. I mean, community members and city council and everybody else just, you know, get to the facts and to get to things being right. And, you know, with what Ms. Gross said, I mean, I would just say, you know, make your case for why a new system should be in place or a new paradigm should be in place and, you know, find, you know, a couple of people at the city council that would support you and we can go from there.
I think that's a heck of a recommendation. Ms. Gross, I hope that you and your associates take it under consideration. Want to thank everybody. Mr. Allen, because we want to move on, but again, we definitely want to thank the chairman of the Public Safety Committee for taking the time to call in. And,
thank you.
James,
thank you very much.
Michelle, and Chairman Yang, thank you. All right, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Well,
right.
Have a great night.
Wow, Mr. Allen, I don't know what to to say there because, man, I know that some people's reputations were taking a beating from Mr. Brown and others about that there was a concern. That was a surprise. Well, what else do we have, Mr. Allen? The phone lines are open, you know.
Yeah, the phone lines open at 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. And the phone lines are wide open. Mr. Edwards, before we get into this heavy piece with State Auditor Rebecca Otto, I was concerned the other day, and I should have pulled it up and had it ready, but I was so interested in this conversation that was just incredible. And the city council person called in, so that was really nice of him.
Yes, sir.
But I am looking on the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits on June 24th this year, McNamara Alumni Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on the campus of the University of Minnesota. They're having a leadership summit. And so, Mr. Edwards, at first, I said, you know, they do that every year, if I'm not mistaken. And I wanted to look at the list of speakers and presenters and things like that because I didn't really look last year. Before I got to it, I got two telephone calls from two Caucasian females that were in shock because they said, "Don, go to the page right now." I'm actually on the page for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits in their 2015. It's called Leadership 2025, a roadmap for the next decade of national nonprofit leadership. And it's June 24th, again, at the McNamara. And I'm looking at the speakers. There's not one black woman or African-American, whatever you prefer. There is one African-American man and a bunch of white guys. Okay, and some of these people we would never ever meet out there anywhere doing anything. And so it concerned me to the point that I know that we have the North Side Achievement Zone. I mean, no matter how much, Mr. Edwards, I disagree with some of their procedures or what they're doing with the kids over North, they're still African-American and control about $5 million a year for a while here, if not more. Then you have Divine Institute, out in the St. Paul suburbs.
Let me get clarification.
Okay.
Maybe we're just mistaken. And so, this was a conference on nonprofits in outstate Minnesota. You mean?
Oh no! This is the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. It's their Leadership 2025
For the entire state, including the urban area.
Everybody.
Okay, I mean, I know we are becoming more and more invisible. It certainly proves the point that black lives don't even exist. But anyways, I guess I was just trying to put a little levity in. I cannot believe that a sophisticated group of movers and shakers heading such powerful nonprofits saw so little value in bringing forward more than, quote-unquote, the token African-American. That's kind of like this was 1932 or 35, or I mean, even in the 1940s, when situations like that, we at least have two or three Negroes would be invited to sit in on the nonprofits and etc. I mean, really, this is for the entire state. I mean, this just wasn't for rural Minnesota.
Yeah, no, it's for the whole state of Minnesota, Miss Everett. I called this Mr. Pratt, one of the co-executive directors, and I sent him a link to the show. I sent the agency a link to the show, and I mean, this is a little bit troubling, you know. What they're representing, Mr. Edwards, is what is represented across the board for the African-American or black community in Minnesota. You know, this takeaway we don't exist, we don't matter, our issues.
And by the way,
for
Mr. Platt and his associates, there was a Negro or black presence in Minnesota when we were still a territory.
Yeah, Mr. Edwards, we have a phone call. You're live on the air. Who's calling?
Hi, this is John Pratt with the Council of Nonprofits.
Oh, Mr. Pratt. Go right in. Mr. Allen, you've
talked
with Mr. Pratt. You've been contacting with him. Thank you, Mr. Pratt, for calling in. Go ahead, Mr. Allen.
We appreciate it. Yeah, and I know you've heard me just going over your Leadership 2025 conference that's coming up on June 24th at the McNamara Alumni Center in Minneapolis. And, you know, like I said, if you've heard, there were some concerns, and I did reach out to you. And, this is troubling. I received probably about 12 phone calls today, and I'm in the process of writing about it. But I guess I want to know, how does this kind of thing happen in 2015 still? How does the black body get neglected to the point of lack of inclusion or exclusion in this point? I mean, I know Sean Lewis. He's a great guy. He sends me emails. I send him emails. I'm on a listserv or whatever with him. And that's great, but I see these women that are controlled. Whatever you say, minority, well, we got minorities. We have women. I asked a guy at a college campus, just a short story here, a young white guy, what he thought about his group. Did he have diversity? And he told me, well, yeah, she likes to wear pink dresses and she likes to wear blue jeans, so our group is diverse. And I'm hoping that's not the mistake with this that's going on here.
Yeah.
Would you like to explain a little bit of it for us?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, partly it's hard to look at just sort of we do events each year. And I don't know if you saw the email. I sent you our program from last year. So last year we had 26 speakers. Actually, and you specifically said, you know, what about black women? Last year it was sort of 9 out of 61 speakers were African-American women. The part of the keynote, many of the sort of session leaders and proposers. At last year's conference, 26 out of 61 speakers were people of color. This year, the keynote is done by Dr. Maikao Hang with the Wilder Foundation. The leadership awards will be presented by Stephanie Haddad. There's sort of it's a broad spectrum, but year to year, I absolutely agree with your point that the African American community is important, and our leaders and have been sort of under the gun for some sort of unfair situations, and you know, was certainly aimed to include everyone over the broad time. But you're right. In this case, we don't have, we have one African-American woman now on this year's leadership agenda. But actually, that's probably going to change in the next week or so.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, I guess, Mr. Edwards, do you have any questions for Mr. Pratt at this time?
No, it's clear that Mr. Platt probably threw questions that you posed, that they're taking a look at whatever their protocol process selection is. I would certainly like to encourage Mr. Platt to maintain contact and liaison with you, Mr. Allen, to see that in 2016 that we have a little better complexion, if you will, on this conference, particularly in the 2016 will be an election year. And many nonprofits will be about, well, they're, you know, they have to be, they have to be appropriately and legally correct, if you will, in how they deal with the process. But we all know that in the communities of color, the nonprofits are oftentimes encouraged to help encourage, you know, voter registration, turnout to vote, blah, blah, blah. 2016 is going to be an election year, probably going to be a volatile election year in America.
Yep.
And so I'm really hoping that that you and Ms. Pratt will maintain contact, consultation, and et cetera. And maybe in, oh, 2 or 3 months, Mr. Allen, you will be able to come back on our program, the Don and Ron program, and indicate that Mr. Pratt has indicated a policy, if you will, an approach, and as specific expectations. Ms. Pratt, let me ask you this question. Is there or was there any kind of pushback from maybe some of your board because maybe you had too many black women last year, or is that just something that doesn't happen?
No, I think it depends on the subjects and sort of how the program evolves. But let me just say that absolutely we're strong supporters of nonprofits, encouraging people to vote. Certainly for the nonprofits, it has to be nonpartisan. And there are pretty easy ways that nonprofits can follow all the election laws, but still nonprofits can be a great way to be a trusted voice to help people know where to vote, get good voting information, and sponsor candidate forums.
All right. Okay. Well, I have the utmost trust and expectation that you have kind of seen a light at the end of the tunnel, and that
we'll certainly see
a better presence. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we've all been in Minnesota too long, as I said just before you came on the air. There has been a African American, Black, Negro presence in Minnesota since before it was a territory,
mm-hmm.
and so we're talking now the 1820s. You know what
great.
I mean? So we've been here a long time. Whatever our role is perceived to be, we've been here, and you know, we just like to have a place at the table. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
All
absolutely
right.
Not.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Well, Mr. Allen, this is your guest, but go ahead.
You want
to finish it up?
I appreciate you calling in, and I will keep in touch and keep in view, and
okay.
then we'll see. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks for including
all right.
me. I know.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Thank you. Mr. Allen, very quickly before we go to, and we now I see we have 28 minutes. I had promised the heirs of the three people that I'm about to identify that I would do this because we do not have a black museum.
mm-hmm.
An African-American museum here in Minnesota, I guess we just have to kind of do it, if you will. You know, $3 million just kind of gone, disappeared. But I had made a commitment and promise to some African-Americans whose ancestors, quote-unquote, relatives, loved ones, and et cetera, were part of a historical activity, if you will. And actually what I'm doing, Mr. Allen, I'm looking into and pulling out from my archives a story in the Minneapolis Tribune on December 13th, 1938.
Mm.
And I want to send out our appreciation and memorialize three of the first African-American residents, the very first three, Mr. Allen, who integrated public housing in the Sumner Field community in North Minneapolis, if you will. And they would be Miss Sophie Austin, a 71-year-old
okay.
African-American woman at that time, of course, obviously has passed over to the other side, if you will. And two of the first, along with Miss Austin, African-American residents of public housing in Minneapolis, you know what I mean? And it would be Miss Wilhelmina Brown and her three children. We want to, you know, indicate that to her family. We may talk about it if anyone has any interest. And then the third person, third mother, third African-American woman, and et cetera, Miss Roy M. Hugger. These three African-American women on the 12th day of December in the year of our Lord, 1938, became the first Negro residents of public housing, accepted into public housing in the state of Minnesota. And so we just wanted to
wow.
kind of do that. Yeah. And again, for those that like to run and et cetera, It is a copyrighted story. In fact, the the title is Life Begins at Sumner Field for 125 Families, All Packed and Ready to Move into Their New Homes, Mr. Allen. And again, this was the in the 13th day of December 1938. Again, Miss Austin, Miss Brown, and Miss Hugger. God bless them.
Yeah, yeah, I have to say that.
So I was getting some texts, Mr. Edwards. We're still live on the air for those that want to catch up and call in or talk to the host. Our number 347-426-3904. And yes, we had Bob Yang, we had Mr. Pratt from the Minnesota Council on Nonprofits, we had Michelle Gross from Citizens United Against Police Brutality, Dave Bickering, associate of Ms. Gross. So it was a very deep conversation.
And a long time, let me just say, and a long time activist in the area of police community relations, as has been Ms. Gross. So very, very appreciative of them taking the time to discuss these matters with us. But I think we really need to go to the Rebecca Otto, because she committed herself and shared her time with us. The governor had told her that he was not going to call a special session so long as the language stripping her office of state auditor of its authority and power was still in play. Unfortunately, it appears that the governor backed away, maybe even reneged. But Mr. Allen and our technical staff have put together some specific excerpts from that interview. When and if you're ready, Mr. Allen.
Here we go. To audit. And if you could explain
that. Yeah, pretty
that
much.
Our listeners don't get this information, so if you can explain it, that'd be great. Go ahead.
I'm happy to. So a real injustice happened to Minnesotans the last night of session. In the middle of the night, a deal was made between a couple of people in a back room, you know, when they were sleep-deprived, and good things usually don't come out of that for Minnesotans and the taxpayers. And basically, my office, you know, we watch when government takes your money, taxpayer money. Our office is there to make sure that they're following the laws when they're handling it and spending it, and, you know, because that's really important and that no one's taking it. So basically, what some legislators did in the middle of the night was they neutered our office. They're basically taking away our audit authority. Now, why in the world would I be called the state auditor if we're not going to be able to conduct audits? And I'm very, you know, what it does is it really reduces transparency and accountability of over $1 billion just at the county level. And so, you know, I want people to know about it. Governor Dayton, the interesting thing is he's the former state auditor.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, and he has said that he is going to make a special there's a precondition he's going to say before he's willing to call a special session that they have to repeal this thing. And because, you know, when we audit government, when my staff who are in government audit government, our only client are Minnesotans. We're there to watch out for their best interests when we're looking at that money. And when a private firm audits local government, their client is the board, the city council or the county commissioners. And it's a slightly different relationship. The taxpayer is not their client. So, you know, in the middle of the night, I feel like people were robbed of something that they don't even know is going to go away. So what I'm hoping people are going to do is contact their state representatives and state senators. And if you don't know who they are, you can look them up on the Secretary of State's website. But they need to hear from people that this is not acceptable, because I'm not sure who wants to hide from what. You know, we do our job without fear or favor.
Our listening audience should be advised that you were just reelected to the position of state auditor with very high marks. Let me ask two specific questions on this, Otto. Number one, what is the constitutional implications? What does the Constitution say about the right, the existence of the office of state auditor? Is there a constitutional violation here?
Well, that's a really good question. And, you know, I'm not an attorney, but my, you know, I have some attorneys looking at this. I'm named in the Constitution. So the state auditor is named in the Constitution. That's why we call it a constitutional office. And we do have three branches of government. You know, we have three branches of government in Minnesota, and one when one branch tries to run another branch over, that's usually not a good thing.
You're absolutely correct, madam.
Yeah, that's why I'm glad that I
asked that question. Now, on that particular question, because when we still have more than a sufficient, and let me just say again, we are very appreciative here because it is very rare for a high-ranking and powerful public official to take time to call into a radio talk show, okay? Now, could you explain to our listening audience, this is a part of a teaching moment, the difference between the state auditor, who is created by Constitution and elected by the voters, and the legislative auditor, who is an appointee of the legislature? Could you give us the difference with regards to your office and Mr. Noble's office?
I would be so happy to do that for you. It's a teachable moment. So we have two auditors in the state of Minnesota, and as you stated, I'm elected and I'm a constitutional officer and held accountable by the people. The legislative auditor is appointed by the legislature, and so the legislature is his boss. And what we do is we oversee all the local governments. There's over 4,000 of them. What he does is he oversees state government and state programs. And so, you know, he can look at state agencies, you know, how are certain programs working within the schools, all the programs that the legislature creates. And he generally does more of what you call a program audit, where it'll look at how are things working. When we audit our local governments, what we do is we're looking at are there books in proper order? Is someone monkeying with them, you know? And so we want to make sure the financial statements are fairly stated. It's not really exciting, but it's very, very important. And we also focus on whether they're following the laws. And so it's kind of, that's the difference. But, you know, I get held accountable by the people. I don't kowtow to anybody. I answer to the voters. So when people say, well, who's your boss? Is the governor your boss? No, the people are my boss. And I work very hard for people every day. And I want to say it's an honor for me to be on your show. I thank you for having me.
We thank you. A couple more questions, if you would. Ms. Allen, thank you. The decision to pull this late midnight charade, were you at any point given a heads up, a warning, a notification by both sides of the aisle that this amendment was pending? It was, you know, did anyone reach out to you and indicate, well, this is something we think we want to do? Was there any discussion with you and with your office?
Well, that's a good question, too. So the House had heard the bill and maybe twice. And they didn't do a lot with it, but they tried to overhaul the whole statute where we have our audit authority, which actually created a huge mess. The Senate never heard the bill. They had no intention of hearing the bill. They told me, nope, we're not going to be processing that. And generally the Senate won't pull things, you know, they won't accept things if they haven't, again, held public hearings, given the public chance to, you know, weigh in on issues. And so I know somebody in leadership in the Senate, and they knew the deal between Speaker Daudt and Senate Majority Leader Bach. And the global deal did not include privatization of our audits. It only included a study that they might do. And so when, in the middle of the night, and I'm sitting in the room and everybody's sleep-deprived, this thing starts to happen, someone questioned and said, wait, hey, hang on, wait a second, this isn't part of the deal. And they thought they could just slide it right on through. And I got up to the table, and I said, wait a minute. I was shocked. And so I stood up, and I basically had to speak out for the people. And so I spoke for a while, and I sat down, and they kept going. And I said, you know what, I'm not leaving this table. I said, this is an outrage. And I let them have it, because the thing is they're doing it in the middle of the night when nobody's watching. Well, that's the worst way to make laws, you know, because it really, it's an aberration of the process. And it robs people of the, you know, transparency and accountability that they deserve. And, you know, people need to be able to trust government. You know, if we can't trust our government, we're in big trouble, you know?
In fact, I have to say that that you are making a very compelling argument, because I, you know, as a naive person, I thought that this only happened in the Duma or some banana republic. And so, I mean, I cannot envision that something like this happened, but it clearly did. Now, I'd like for you to just to repeat once more. The governor, Mark Dayton, and of course, both you and he are two things. You're of the same party, but more importantly, you are both constitutional officers of the state of Minnesota. The governor is saying that he is requiring a repeal and of the Pacific Midnight Action, or he will not move ahead with the special session. Did I hear you right?
Yeah, that's what he said three times in public, that it would be a precondition to a special session. So he's not going to call it unless he gets the, you know, House and Senate leadership to agree that it's got to go. And, you know, what we need to do now is put pressure on the, you know, legislators. They need to hear from people that they say, you know what, that wasn't a good idea. You know, you shouldn't, you know, again, because there was an election, I was reelected, right?
Yes, right.
And I voted
and
for
so
you.
So it's really taking something away.
And I did, too, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Wow. Let me ask this question also, because we're just so grateful for you taking the time to educate the citizens and the voters of the state of Minnesota, because this is really something in the dark shadows. Why have we, I mean, I already kind of know the answer to my question. Why is it that we've not heard anything from the Fourth Estate? This is a very serious matter. And I have no recall, Mr. Allen, of seeing this on any of the you know, the stations, newspapers, or et cetera. Ms. Otto, is there something at play here, or what? Or is this not newsworthy, or what? What you're thinking?
Well, there's been some stories, and they're tucking it into some of the bigger stories about how the session really did not end well, and it really ended quite poorly. But, you know, people don't always understand audits, and that's part of the problem. That's why I think they thought they could slip this through, because then they're like, well, people won't know what they're losing. Well, they're losing a lot, and my job as a state auditor is to make sure that I make sure that the voters and Minnesotans are aware of what was taken from them, that it's not acceptable. And I don't expect them to understand what a financial audit is or a legal compliance audit is, but they would understand that, let's say, you know, we saw a situation, because we're experts in county audits, we saw some county law enforcement agencies that had created a program that wasn't in compliance with the law. They were driver diversion programs. And the legislature would not have known but for my office doing a study and issuing findings on these things. The private firms who were auditing some of the counties were not issuing findings on these illegal programs. You got to have somebody who's watching out for our best interests. We could have lost our federal state highway aid because of this situation, which we can't afford either. So you got to have somebody there at the end of the day who's there for the people. And they're trying to neuter the office, take away the voice of someone who's going to do their job without fear or favor, and it's just wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just say on behalf of myself and I think my colleague, Mr. Allen, that we will make sure that this stays in front of the public in our very small program, certainly for the remainder of the summer, if you will, because what you're talking about in closing from this side, from the left, as I identify myself, is we're talking about constitutional tampering. And that's just not a good, healthy thing for democracy, and you've kind of enunciated that in the last number of minutes. And it makes me, Mr. Allen, feel real uneasy when I see... Yes, sir, Mr. Allen.
That was the interview, the 12-minute interview with Minnesota State Auditor Rebecca Otto.
And could you, Mr. Allen, for the purposes of our international and domestic audience, could you give us the date of that particular interview?
That was the 20. Let me go back to my calendar here. I don't have my calendar pulled up.
It was three Wednesdays ago. The reason I asked the question is that much of what State Auditor Otto said to us was reprinted in the Minneapolis Star Tribune just a couple days ago. And I feel bad that they did not give us credit for plagiarizing or quote unquote pirating a very detailed interview with the state auditor. Their story talked in terms of backroom dealings, and if you go back and take a look at the Star Tribune story, much of their information was taken directly from this interview with the state auditor on this black radio talk show program 3 weeks ago. Uh-oh.
Yeah, we have a caller.
Go ahead, caller.
10 minutes and 50 seconds left of the show. Caller, you're live on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Just checking in this evening with you, gentlemen. How y'all doing?
Yeah,
sorry,
right
now,
what can we do for you?
You know, I was listening to the interview, and I remember because I was in Texas during the interview, and I think I was the next call after she got off. And I, too, didn't have a chance to text or inbox Don to ask him about what I read too, and so you just shed a light on the fact that the major newspaper decided not to give you brothers credit on the information that they got from this particular interview. I mean, the fact is, no one, the Star, the Strib or the Pioneer Press, no one bothered to interview Mrs. Otto, yet you guys decided to and didn't give not an ounce of credit to you guys. That sucks, and to me, speaks to the characters of the people that are running those two papers.
Thank you.
Ridiculous.
All right.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Ridiculous. So I appreciate you guys keeping up and flowing in the community, and keep up the good work, fellas.
All right. Thank you,
all right,
sir.
Thank you, sir.
All
right. Thank you, sir. Good looking out.
No problem.
Mr. Nelson.
In fact, in the article that Mr. Nelson is talking about, we refer our listeners to go back and check that story, because what they said is that they did not talk to Miss Otto until the day before they printed the story on a Wednesday. They indicated they had talked to her on a Tuesday. And that was 2 weeks after she had been on this program.
Ooh.
Yeah. But the lines are still open. The lines, we've had a very interesting program, if you will. Some very revealing things about the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department. I wonder, well, we don't even talk about the commission anymore. Do you know that the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission has not had a public hearing on anything pertaining to their responsibility and charter for almost 15 years?
Yeah. Wow. Oh, my.
Yeah. It's been 15 years.
Long.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it kind of makes you wonder why they're wrong. By the way, we're waiting to hear from the Advisory Committee to the powerful United States Civil Rights Commission on some of the matters that have been discussed and are quote-unquote, extremely intense in the African-American community. We are aware that appointments, an application for appointments to the Advisory Committee to the United States Civil Rights Commission, who has subpoena powers and et cetera, that applications are being accepted as of July 1, right, Mr. Allen?
Yes, 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 exactly.
Yeah, yeah, looks like we need a, yeah. Oh, that's right, because the Minneapolis City Civil Rights Director, Ms. Corvell, was on the committee. That's the same Ms. Corvell that turned Mr. Allen and myself down when we asked for a civil rights investigation of the death of a young African-American by the name of Smith in the facility, the YWCA downtown. And she turned us down. In fact, if anyone chooses to challenge us, Mr. Allen will produce the emails and the letters and the exchanges between his office and Ms. Corvell. Later, the city made a significant payout, the millions of dollars, if you will, to the family of Mr. Smith for his death, if you will. And so just kind of want to remind people of that, of what's going on. I just cannot quite understand, based on what Ms. Gross and her associates shared with us earlier this evening. I just don't know. And then, you know, the NAACP president is also the chairperson of the Advisory Committee to the United States Civil Rights Commission. I was wondering why they did not speak to the issue of suspensions and expulsions last night at the Board of Education meeting at 1250 West Broadway. I guess we're not going to be able or going to be allowed or be sanctioned, if you will, to have a discussion about the disproportionate and criminal suspensions and expulsions of African-American children as early as kindergarten. Here in this town, we put them out from kindergarten to 12th grade. We just get rid of them. So by the time they should have been in their 12th year of education within the public education arena, that they don't have to worry about it because they will not be walking with their degree. You know what I'm saying? And I think this is a good time, because just the last week, many of our what's left of that cadre walked across the stage. But in Minneapolis, by the way, many of our youngsters are allowed to put on their cap and gown, but that paper that you see in their hand that you think is a diploma is blank.
Yeah. Yep. I agree.
I agree. Yeah.
But I really was thinking that the NAACP and the United States Civil Rights Commission's Advisory Committee in Minnesota was going to speak to the expulsion issue. Wow. Didn't happen, brother. Didn't happen. You know, we said it before. It's clear black lives across the board really don't matter in this town.
Not at all, Mr. Edwards. I'm just looking here, getting some texts and trying to route them. I said, you know, we got 4 minutes left of the show. And
that's all we got, buddy.
Yeah, that's all we got. This might be the same caller, but then again, he might be in the queue, but I need to check. You're live on the air. Who's calling? Okay, maybe not. Okay, not going to worry about it. They're in the queue. But, this is a pretty good show. We had a lot of people, got a lot of accolades on Facebook happening right now from people listening that were happy with the information and that was put out there. And, you know, we have the podcast that is available within less than 5 minutes after we get off the air that you can download. And you don't even have to download it. Just pops up on your screen. You can listen to it while you're cleaning the house or something from your computer speaker.
And there you go. And I am so thrilled that we are able to retain the podcast and et cetera, because I think, listen real closely for those that have been tuned in, and our numbers are significant, to what State Auditor Rebecca Otto said with regards to the promise made by the governor of the state of Minnesota to protect the constitutional integrity of all constitutional office under Minnesota government and under the Constitution of the state of Minnesota. He didn't keep his promise, Don.
No, he didn't.
His promise. He broke his promise.
We have another caller also that we want to get in, but I just want to say one thing before I go to that caller. This is the only black program in the Twin Cities that has a podcast that is nationally broadcast.
That's right. Our caller? Get our caller.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
I'm live on the air?
You're live on the air for 3 minutes and 3 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry for calling so late. This is Mr. M. I was at the I was at the Minnesota Twins game tonight, and I just got home. They dismally lost, and
I think they're out of first place, didn't they?
Yeah, I think they're going to come crashing down Kansas City. It's a sweep, and I think they're going to come back. Even though I support Mr. Molitor, I think he's a tremendous improvement over Gardenhire.
Ron Gardenhire, yes.
I thought that was an utter failure, losing 90 games for 4 years and still keeping your job. You know, there was a gentleman by the name of Ray Rhodes. I don't know if you guys remember him. He coached the Green Bay Packers of all teams.
Yes, he did.
And Mr. Rhodes, you know, coached them to, above 500, and he lost his job.
He sure did. He later coached the Philadelphia Eagles.
Very successfully.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did.
You know, and then there's another gentleman by the name of he coaches the Toronto Raptors now. He used to coach the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Dwayne Casey,
yes.
Yeah.
And he was at 500. He was at 500, and then they fired him.
With the Minnesota Timberwolves.
And he's went on and took the moribund Toronto Raptors into the playoffs.
Yes.
And
yes.
The Timberwolves have not been 500 since they fired him at that stage of the season.
Absolutely correct. And got rid of Kevin Garnett and Latrell Sprewell and Sam Cassell. And it hasn't been the same since, has it?
Yeah. No, it hasn't. But, you know, what can I say? You know, there's a gentleman I saw on TV that called this place the Great Shangri-La. And, people in this place called the Shangri-La. This is a place that basically it hasn't been for us, but we really – and I hope you gentlemen – you know, I was very – I just caught the tail end, and I'm sorry about that. But the fact that you're saying that this is the only program, you know, I mean, with this type of information being put out in the community, and it should have a wider audience. It should have a broader base.
Mm-hmm.
And why it does, but I think if you continue to do it, I think if you continue to espouse the truth that you're espousing, it can only go up from here. Because, see, the truth will win. I really believe. I believe the Bible's right, as my dad said. I believe that.
And set you free. Yes, yes.
And we have less.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. We have less than 20 seconds left of the show. I'd like to thank.
Okay,
you.
Well, I'm gonna let you gentlemen go. Thank you, and I will be back.
Listeners.
And I'll be
right here for you.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Allen. Wow, we could have gone on for two or three hours. Anyway, Jane Brown, take us home.